Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this evening, the Stephen with a V to my Stephen with a PH, it's Cade.
Hey, Scott, how's it going tonight?
It's going well. It's following up last night's Megathon podcasting with Jason. Actually, I just realized that this is the first podcast we're going to be releasing for some listeners since a Game of Thrones one a month ago, and for other listeners since May, from what I understand, when we did our last superhero one, I guess.
Has it been that long, really?
Yeah, it's kind of been crazy. But wow. It just occurred to me, since we kind of recorded them out of order, because I want this one to be the first one, and people will understand why, you know, just based on what the topic is. I should just say right now, yeah, we're glad to be back recording. Just been away for a while. Real life has gotten in the way. You know, Dan is extremely busy between his work and his vacations and his adventuring and so on and so forth. And I've just been dealing with real life and the misery of it and such. But I've been stockpiling so much TV watching over the last several weeks. I've been dying to get behind the microphone again and get some podcasting done. So we kind of enlisted some of our superhero geeky podcast co-conspirators here. So some of you will hear within the next week or so, I've already recorded two other podcasts with Jason where we're going to cover a handful of quite bingeable shows, all of which you can find on Netflix. But we're starting tonight with Cade about quite possibly the most bingeable show
on Netflix to that, yeah.
In some time. So without any further banter or ado, let's get to it, because the reason we're here tonight, we're here to be talking about, wow, the eloquence has left me. I blame that on last night. Anyway, we're here to talk about Stranger Things.
Okay, here's the question. How long have you known about this series coming into? Because my first moment of realizing this series existed was Saturday morning. Watching a YouTube video, there's a preview before it. It was the scene where Winona Ryder, her character's in the sheriff's office with Hopper, and they're discussing. And it's just that little back and forth, and then it quick shots to random things from throughout the series. And I'm like, I don't know what this series is about, because that really didn't tell me. I'm in. I want to find out. And I started Saturday. I watched two episodes and finished the rest of them on Sunday. Like, from just a one-minute little trailer before a YouTube video, I found the series that I never knew I wanted and fell in love with and immediately had to finish it. I haven't watched Daredevil Season 2 yet.
Oh my god, really?
Yes, but I immediately sat down and said, this is my goal, I'm finishing this series. I want to watch it all today. I don't want to watch two episodes, take a couple days. I want to get it done, because it enraptured me that much.
Wow. Well, usually when there is a big TV show coming down the pike, I'm usually well aware of it. You know, it's usually on my radar, you know, several months in advance. Like, I was getting excited for the first season of True Detective back in late September, and it didn't come out until, I think, January. Or shows like Fargo and any other number of shows over the last few years. I didn't hear about this show until maybe 2 weeks ago. And even then, I really wasn't paying that close attention. Because I heard there was a show that was coming out on Netflix that was going to... I had heard it was going to be like some sort of like Amazing Stories, Steven Spielberg-like show or something. That was what I had actually thought I had heard. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And it wasn't until, I think literally the day it came out and people started posting stuff about it on Facebook, and I did see Steven Spielberg's name mentioned, but then I saw Stephen King's name mentioned, and I was like, okay. And again, I still don't know what the show is about. I've not actually read an article at this point. I'm seeing like the little blurbs, you know, of articles that are being posted on Facebook and whatnot. So for me, it wasn't until I actually was over a friend's house Saturday night, and we decided to like watch something on Netflix before they kicked me out. And, you know, because you can only take so much of me around, trust me. So we mentioned, oh, Stranger Things, you want to check that out? So I watched it, and oh my gosh, it hooked me within the first 5 minutes. You know, not just so much the opening scene, but it was really once we got into the opening credits and I started seeing what they were doing here. And I went, oh my, I think I'm falling in love with this. But, you know, I wanted to give it the entire episode to really make up my mind about it, because, you know, maybe it starts off strong and then, you know, falls apart. But, yeah, within a couple hours later, I'm home, and I said, I need to get back to that show now.
Yeah.
You know, and I ripped through about, I think, four of them, you know, up until like 4 a.m, went to sleep, woke up at some point the next day, finished off the rest of the series, went back and started watching bits and pieces of the earlier episodes, because I kept thinking, I bet there's little things I missed and I wanted to, you know, make note of here or there, because this, I was so excited about what I was watching. And I mean, I've watched some things in recent weeks that I've said, oh, that would be a fun show to podcast about. You know, like I've been, like Preacher, for example. I was like, oh, that would be a fun show to podcast about. And, you know, me and you might actually get together early next week and do a podcast about Preacher. You know, spoiler for nobody. Oh, by the way, in case anyone hasn't picked up on this already, this podcast will not be spoiler free. We are assuming anyone listening to this podcast,
you're going,
right, you will have watched the series.
We're going deep into the Upside Down with this one. Don't worry. We're going deep.
If you haven't watched the series yet, stop listening. Go watch it. You can find this podcast at some point later on. Maybe you subscribe to us on iTunes. I don't know. But really, Gus, we plan to be talking about anything and everything about this series, and we're not holding back. But yeah, it enraptured me in so many different ways. You know, it tapped into nostalgia without going to the point where it was only about nostalgia, if that makes any sense.
Right. It took nostalgia, but it used it to tell its own story. So while you felt it there, it wasn't just shoved in your face or hitting you over the head. It's like, we took it and we've wrapped it in our own little thing. Here, enjoy it. Even in so much as the intro, which, it, you know, it's brand new, but it's still something. And for people who might not have grown up on TV, and you might have only watched these series like on Netflix or something, and you never paid attention to like how the opening the themes and theme songs in 80s TV was one of the biggest thing. You knew shows by the theme. You could tell the show was on because the theme, because you didn't always know what was coming on at the time. But that minute the theme for like Dallas started, you knew where. This show took that. It realized how important that opening theme was. And just the whole intro was glorious 80s and the way it panned on letters and all came together and the music playing. And you're just like, I'm in for something here that I think I'm going to enjoy. And I can't say, I don't know if someone who didn't grow up on that kind of TV will have that same attachment to that intro that, say, we might have of how much it made us happy just seeing how it played out.
Well, the interesting about that intro, even more so than that, is if you go back and you watch it, they do it with, there's a certain quality to it, a grainy quality.
Right.
It looks like it's a well-worn VHS tape.
Mm-hmm.
You can see those little video sparkles or pixel points that pop up here and there, just the way it would have been if you had taped something off a TV and then watched it later that night. It had that exact look. And it did have the feel of the opening credits. It had that feel of, TV shows. I was thinking more of a lot of movies also had that.
Yeah, I could see that too.
Opening credit kind of feel to it. I'm going to have more to say about those opening credits a little bit later, but I'm saving that for a special segment I have in my mind. but back to the show overall and the nostalgia quality. It's interesting because, and this was, I'm lifting this a little bit from a conversation I had online on Facebook. I cannot remember which person I had it with, so and I think they are a listener, so my apologies if I don't mention you. I have a feeling it might have been Jonathan, but it might not have been. I'm not sure. We were talking about the fact that there's been these shows that take place in the 80s that tap into the nostalgia, but I would also then go take it further without making it about that. I know there's a sitcom I have not seen called The Goldbergs, which obviously takes place in the 80s, and they use it more for humor as well. But I'm thinking more like shows like The Americans, which takes place in the early 80s, and they use a lot of events as well as different pop culture things as touchstones or even plot points at times. But they don't hit you over the head, but they will make you smile from time to time. Or the show *Halt and Catch Fire*, which is on AMC, also takes place in the 80s, and they don't pound it into your head. It's not like they're throwing Teddy Ruxpins and Cabbage Patch Dolls at you every other minute, but it still has that feel. Now, this show, this series, I should say, maybe on some level takes it a step further because it's paying homage to so many things, whereas those shows really aren't. They're more about just the years that it takes place, while this is really referencing so many different movies and books of the era. But it's kind of like what you were saying about people who didn't grow up watching those TV shows might miss the feeling they'll get from that opening credits. I would say the same thing just for if you didn't grow up going to the theater to see those movies, this might not impact you quite as much. Although a lot of people have seen most of those things on, you know, DVD or cable or whatever, it's still not quite the same. You know, because it doesn't imprint on you the way it did if you were a child of the early 80s.
Yeah.
You know, like myself, for example. So, again, as we were saying, this show for me practically came out of nowhere. It reminds me a little bit of like the whole Cloverfield phenomenon with J.J. Abrams, where we didn't know anything about it, and all of a sudden, boom, there it was.
Yeah, it just popped up. Because there was references to it that we didn't know were references to that movie being made or happening, and then suddenly it's there, and people are like, oh, there's all this stuff. Oh, that's what that was. This didn't even have that though.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this has been kind of a thing for the last year or so where something will just come out of nowhere. It'll just surprisingly drop out of nowhere, like, you know, Beyonce releasing the Lemonade album out of nowhere, or Louis C.K. Yeah. releasing his Horace and Pete online show, again, out of nowhere, you know, and I still haven't seen that because I don't want to spend a dollar. but I think you can see it on his website, but you have to, like, pay a dollar or something like that. But I kind of feel that way about this show, even though I know must have been articles about it for the last couple of weeks, but because I wasn't aware of them, for me it was like that.
But yeah, like when I started looking up, because the minute I was finished the series, my thing became, I want to read everything I can, read all these interviews, and suddenly I'm finding articles from months ago talking about looking for cast of the show and trying to find the right people. I'm like, all right, clearly I've just decided to disconnect myself from all this because I never once saw anything.
I think it's just because it was done without it being like a huge hype machine. And it wasn't like, you know, the front page of any specific publication or getting like a lot of, you know, juice or building up a lot of, what's the word I'm thinking? Buzz is the thing, phrase I'm thinking of. Like, whether it be on HitFix or Bleeding Cool or any of those different websites that people access to find out about upcoming TV shows and movies. And so it just, and because there wasn't anyone really connected to the project that would have caused that to happen, you know, it wasn't like the creators behind it were terribly well known or like, ooh, you know, because like the guys behind this, the Duffer Brothers, you know, basically what they're known for is they wrote a few episodes of Wayward Pines. Oh, by the way, the show, 1,000 times better than Wayward Pines.
Agreed.
But other than that, all these guys have done, they've done like a handful of shorts and some little scene movie from last year called Hidden, you know, starring the guy who's Tarzan now and was in True Blood, Alexander Skarsgård, is how you say his name?
Yeah.
But that's pretty much it. The only other person connected to this is who directed some of the episodes was Sean Levy, who, you know, as a director of some fame, but that he's known for directing comedies. You know, he's directed, you know, the Night of the Museum movies and stuff like that. He actually directed some episodes of Kimmy Schmidt, you know?
Yeah.
Which has no connection to this whatsoever.
And then even with your actor choice, the top two would be Winona Ryder and Matthew Modine.
Yeah.
And those aren't two names that are going to have suddenly websites pop up talking about the article, this new series these two are in. Yeah. They're not at that point.
Yeah, they're not, as they used to say, they don't put asses in the seats.
Right.
You know. But, of course, and once you start watching the series and find out what it's about, it's no coincidence that they picked, like, two actors who came to fame in the 80s themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I think Matthew Modine, I think, oh, 80s. When I think Winona Ryder, I think, 80s, you know. I mean, a little bit 90s, but more 80s. You know, we have Heathers, Beetlejuice, that whole thing. Those are all 80s stuff. But, yeah, you know, we haven't touched on the story of this as of yet. Maybe we can dip our feet into that a little bit. Because basically, you know, this is... You know, there's so many things going on here because it's, you know, it's sci-fi, but it's horror, but it's also about, you know, families and relationships and whatever. And again, I didn't know what it was about going into, which was kind of awesome. It was really nice to put a TV show on and go into it totally cold. I've gone into movies that way, but TV shows, I'm hard-pressed to remember the last time I put on a TV show not knowing anything about it.
Having no notions or in, yes, there's a freeness that you get because you have no preconceptions of what this is going to be. In your head, you didn't build this show up to be something, and then the show comes on, it's totally not that show to you. You're like, this is not what they advertised it was going to be. This is not that. This is, what is this going to be? What will I get out of this show?
Yeah. Exactly. You have little to no preconceived notions. I mean, admittedly, I did hear about the Spielberg and Stephen King thing. That was it. But I didn't know how far they were going with that. I didn't read the articles. I didn't know if it would just be a reference or two, or they were going to go over the top, or what they were going to do. I soon became aware, you know, when I was about 10, 15 minutes into, like, okay, I think I know what this is going to be. And then it just kept going beyond that. It's like, and I was like, okay, maybe we need to hold it back a little bit. You know, maybe it's too much. But then I loved it so much, I didn't care. But another thing I really liked about the series, speaking of casting, is that I liked the casting of the kids specifically. That it all felt very real to me. And they really, between the actors that they chose, and, you know, and then you factor in the wardrobe and the makeup, whatever. You totally believe that what you're watching could have easily been made in 1983. It really had a very authentic feel. That's the phrase I'm looking for. If that makes any sense.
Right. They definitely – they did the small things, small little bits that connect. Like, this is what kids of this time period would do. Them playing a Dungeons & Dragons-style game. Them having their walkie-talkies, riding their bikes to their friend's house, going on adventure and thinking of something that's what they were going into, just going into it. They were ready to be in an adventure. These are things you think of. And that was one of the enjoyable parts is that was another thing. It's those adventure-style movies kids had in the 80s, Goonies and all of that type of stuff where kids just went on adventures. They didn't have someone looking over it. They just went off and did things. It has that. You have these kids who are just ready to go on this adventure. They're playing a game, but then they realize this is real. We can do this like real life now for us. And it's one of those things, and it's because of the kids' casting and because how they were written, they were believable, that made it interesting to you. Like so many times they write kids and they're terribly written and you're like, that's an adult talking. Yes. You didn't get that with these kids. That's a kid speaking. That's someone who's remembering what he was like as a kid and writing that as opposed to someone like, this is what a kid would say. That's not what a kid would say. You don't know what you're talking about. And maybe it's because they did place it during the 80s. You had writers who could reference how they were might have been at that time. I'm not sure.
Right.
But still, they had the voice of kids, not the voice of an adult, which makes it a lot easier for you to be excited when their stories are coming about, because you can just believe it's kids having an adventure.
Right. And what was also nice about the casting and the writing of these parts was the fact that in many instances throughout the series, obviously you're playing with certain tropes and even borderline cliches that were taken from, you know, inspired from different movies and or just general genres of the time. But then they would do something more with it. And characters that might necessarily have been a very one-dimensional, suddenly they're two-dimensional, suddenly they're three-dimensional. You know, for example, like the guy that Nancy's seeing, Steve. I mean, they could have played that character very one-dimensional. And for a little chunk of time, he is. But then they flesh him out a little bit more, and they give him a little bit more, and they make him a little bit more human. They make him a little bit more believable. They unexpectedly give him even something resembling an arc, which they didn't need to do, but it was nice that they did that.
Well, I actually read an article about, and they asked him specifically about him, and they said at first his character was going to be the super douche, as they put it. He was going to stay that one-dimensional, but. And what they were doing, because they were working on it, they saw the actor and how well he was and how personable he was, and they realized he's too good to use to just do that. And they took the chance to actually do, as you said, create an arc for him where he became more than what he started with. And that, if that character was just the douche the whole movie, the whole show, it would have been terrible. But as you said, giving this character a chance to be something more and breathe and become something made it a better show because they did that.
Right, because I think if you were just going by the first few episodes, you would believe that if the show is going to have a quote-unquote semi-happy ending at all, you think, oh, but Nancy's going to end up with Jonathan. But that's not what they did. They could have. They hint that they're going to go that way, but instead, that's not what they do. And I just remember thinking, oh, I like that they went. They zigged when I thought they were going to zag. I really enjoyed that they did that.
Yeah, it was a nice surprise.
You also have, and beyond the kids, and I think again, I think all the kids are really exceptional. You know, whether it be, you know, our adventurers or the girl who plays Elle, who just her acting with her eyes alone, and because she's not a very. Unlike the two people doing this podcast, she's not a very verbose character.
No, verbal communication is the weak point with young Miss Eleven. So,
but I thought she was really exceptional in it. I mean, very heartbreaking at different points in time. I thought she was great. But you know, then take a character. I'll give you another character which could have been very by the book or not all that interesting, and they just kept giving us a little bit more and a little bit more. The chief, Jim yeah. Hopper. I mean, they do so much with that character, and they give us just these little dribs and drabs of exposition, and it's done in a very clever way from comments from other characters, and that's how you find out through the course of the story that he's not from that town, that he's from the big city, that he probably had to dumb it down to come to Hawkins, and you find out about about his daughter, and you're wondering about that. There's a mystery there. What happened to her? And I know that some folks, when they were watching the show in the first couple of episodes, they were thinking, oh, Ella's going to turn out to be his daughter. And I was going, and I believe that was very possible for a while there,
yeah,
too.
It was a good one because we didn't really know.
But then there's a certain point where there's another kind of like, oh, I don't think so. I don't think that's what it's going to be. And then we find out. And it's heartbreaking. And it's,
yeah.
So they do so much more with that character. And again, did they have to do that technically? Like that whole, I think it's the final episode where while he's in the hazmat suit and he's in the upside down world, we're also getting all the different flashes of his daughter with the terminal cancer and everything that happens there.
Yeah.
They could have not done that. They could have left that out. But I love that they did because it made the story have that much more impact for that character, because we understand why Winona Ryder's character, the mother, why she would be as emotionally fragile and devastated and then thrilled to find her son, but he could have just been like the stoic hero. And I love that they made him kind of relate to what was going on through what had happened in his life years earlier.
The want to save Will, not because I have to be the hero, but because I can save this this child.
Exactly.
I couldn't save my daughter, but I will do everything I have. I'm not going to let another child be lost. And that was, and that is, as you said, that a stoic hero could have worked, but this is a bet. This worked more because it was more emotion attached to it than just the guy who's going to go save the kid. This is someone who, when you start the series, you're like, this guy's a waste. He's the sheriff, but he's a waste. And as you slowly start to see the things fall into place on why he's the way he is. And this is the moment where it's not so much a redemption because there's nothing to redeem, but for him, he sees it as a chance to redeem himself, something he can do that he couldn't before. And it gives more to what his character was.
Right.
It's much more, there's more impact with it at that point.
Right. And that really becomes his focus because he is connecting that to what happened in his own life. So when someone questions the fact that, in a sense, he kind of gives up the location of the other kids in L in order to make this deal so they can go to the upside down dimension to save Will. Although I do believe he thinks that they're going to be able to get out of that anyway, but it's because it's about saving Will.
Right.
And, you know, handle the problem that's in front of you now, deal with the repercussions of that later, I thought. So, plus, I didn't see any other way for him out of that situation, quite frankly. I was trying to come up with one myself, but I was like, no, that makes sense. And it's interesting because it doesn't make him the white shining knight. It means that, you know, oh, he did something which is a little bit fucked up, you know, but you understand it, but he's not perfect. I mean, he's clearly not perfect throughout this entire series, but even in this moment, he's not but like I said, I don't see any other way out of that situation for him. They also ladle in these flashbacks throughout the series of what's happened to Elle while she's been held in this laboratory by Papa, you know, Dr. Martin Brenner. Now, I really thought these scenes were important. I know people didn't necessarily love those scenes as much as the other stuff, maybe because it didn't have that nostalgic flavor for them, there was nothing funny about them. I get that, but I thought they were so important for us to understand her. And it doesn't necessarily take away the mystery of her character, because there's a million things we didn't see. There's a million things we don't know. But why I feel it's important, it's not so that we get a little hint about her power. That's not why. We see that, you know, when she's on the run with them and the different things that she can do. It's to understand the pain she's gone through and why she doesn't want to go back, or why her view is somewhat twisted. It's very interesting that the person who is basically in control of her, you know, her captor, essentially, she refers to as her father, as Papa. That's not a coincidence. That makes it that much worse. That makes it that much creepier than if she'd just been, you know, doctor to her. If that makes any sense.
That's why, because if she was just the doctor, she wouldn't scream and there wouldn't be such sadness and anger when she's being dragged away to the room they throw her into.
Right.
If he's just this doctor, there's nothing, you're not screaming at him because she has no emotion. She wouldn't have emotional connection to this detached doctor. But because he's someone who, as just later scenes, as the scenes play out, you see how he's treating her when he's not doing the experiments. She's creating this connection, emotional connection with him. So when she's being taken away, it's like, why? Why are you letting them do this to me? Why? And it's those scenes help lead to you realizing why she is so stunted in the way she comes off. Why she's not verbal. She doesn't really show any emotion immediately. She's afraid and frightened. And if you didn't have those scenes, then it's just she's just a weirdo. But when you have those scenes, you can realize she was basically created into being this way. It's not a choice to be who she's being right now.
And what's interesting is also keep in mind that the flashbacks that we're seeing look like they're all taking place within the last year or so. So if we say that she's, is she maybe actually 11 or 12 years old herself, I'm guessing?
Somewhere around there.
I kept thinking, she's 11 because she's 11 years old. Like, no, she didn't just get the name 11. It doesn't make any sense. But the point I wanted to make was, because we kind of figure out later on in the series that she must be the daughter of that, I think it's Terry Hawks was the woman's name?
Ives. Ives.
Hawkins is the town. Okay, I kind of crossed them over. Anyway, the point being, that means that Dr. Brenner has had this child since she was basically from as a newborn. Which means that's why she views him as her father, because he's pretty much brought her up that way. But we never see any of that.
No.
So for the people who had any issues with them doing flashbacks, who I kind of go, you're already silly for having issues with that anyway, I'll just point out, hey, they could have given us a lot more flashbacks if they wanted to. They could have shown him with her as a 6-month-old, as a 2-year-old, as a 5-year-old, and her evolving and growing up. We don't see any of that. We don't see the first 10 odd years of her life. So there. another thing I really enjoyed, again, liking how they kind of avoid the obvious or the silly or the cliche. I kind of like the stuff with the teacher, Mr. Clark.
He was a character who could have easily been played for jokes, which most of the time in the really in the 80s he would have been, but they used his chance to make him to look. They looked at him. They showed him through the eyes of the kids. He was the cool guy. That he had all the cool things. He had the interest they had. He wouldn't talk. He didn't talk down to them. He treated them as someone who was like, "Hey, I'm going to show you some cool things. You want to see it?" And it made a better character than just having the laughing, the goofy science teacher. But having a character who, like, when they like, how do we grade a salt bath? How do we do that? Immediately, like, let's call him. He'll tell us. He has all those kind of. He knows that kind of stuff. With the CB radio, when he introduced them to the ham radio system, is like, you can talk to all over the place, and just saying the joy they're saying out of someone who's like, I can't wait to show you this. It made interactions later between them and all of what's going on. It made it better. And so much so at the scene where the blonde woman from the government shows up at his door, I'm thinking, please don't kill him. Please don't kill him.
Yeah.
I like him. I don't want him to die. For a character who wasn't like a Superman character, but they had done it. You liked who he was. That immediately, I'm like, I don't want him dead. Please don't kill him. That's going to suck.
Right.
And that was an interesting choice to make that character that way, instead of what most people usually do with characters like that.
Yeah. They everything you said, 100% right on the mark. A character that I think in lesser capable hands would have been played goofier. You know, because, you know, they were like, oh, look, he's got the goofy mustache, and he's probably going to be, you know, say something kind of dorky, or they're going to roll their eyes at him. And he's like, no, they respect their teacher, and they like him, and vice versa. I really enjoyed those scenes. Good little character. See, I was talking about writing the other day, while we were talking about a project that I'm collaborating on. And one of the things I pointed out during it is that we were focusing a lot on, like, the main character and a couple of the side characters, you know, the wife of the character and so on. And I said, you know what? When you're doing this, every scene, every character, you got to think about them the same way. You got, even if that character is only going to be in that one scene, whatever, but you got to have in your mind a fully realized character. So they don't play as a one-dimensional joke, whatever, that they occupy space for a reason. And you can imagine a backstory if you want. Or you just give the same time and care to these little minor side characters that you do for your major characters. And the payoff is tremendous. And you can see that when you watch really well-done television series. When you see the care that's taken with even the most minor or small characters. And I can, you know, could run off a list of shows that, that do that exceedingly well over the last few years. You know, either, you know, shows like Fargo or Mad Men or, you know, any, you know, Game of Thrones. They all do that. And I like that in this, again, they could have just concentrated more on the nostalgia than on the characters. And what's amazing is that they didn't do that. They really took the care with the character. Even the two bullies, there's just a little bit more to them.
Right.
I mean, they're still, by the end, I mean, you can't make everyone likable. I mean, they have to be still pretty horrible. So they kind of remain pretty horrible by the end of it. I think one of them kind of isn't as bad as the other or something. Just like Steve's two friends, they're still kind of dicks by the end of it. Because just like in life, you know, we remember when we were kids, I mean, there were always people like, no, they're just dicks.
So, yeah, that's who they are. We don't question it. We know what they do.
But there was just so much to enjoy here with the nuanced performances of so many of these people. I mean, there's no one in this cast who I thought phoned it in. But what I like is that there are some performances which are understated to the point of being almost silly as a result of that. And I think that's almost also kind of a nod to movies of that era as well. Like, you know, like some of the different deputies on, I don't know if they're deputies or just other officers, but I'm thinking of the other white guy with the glasses. I mean, he's a bit of a goof, but he felt like he could have been taken out of any one of a million movies from that era. So it really fit. And he, since they didn't spend that much screen time on him, I didn't mind it.
Yeah. And like he had the more reserved partner. Having those two be together it was like, oh, it's that buddy cop. They put a little buddy cop combo in their little TV show here. That's cute.
So I think now might be a kind of a fun time for me to really take a comprehensive rundown and hopefully it will be fairly comprehensive. This is something I came up with and went through. And then I started putting it in a different order, like, oh, should I put this in alphabetical order? Like, oh, no, maybe I should separate this and separate that, whatever. But I mentioned before, you know, as I was watching it, then I actually went back and I watched some parts of different episodes a few more times because I just really wanted to hammer it home. So I've kind of stockpiled this huge list of different references that I caught throughout the series. There's no way this is going to be all of them. I'm sure there's any number I probably missed. I'm sure there's probably some BuzzFeed article with 81 Easter eggs in Stranger Things or something like that out there. So if anyone comes up with any that they think are really solid, you know, feel free to comment on our Facebook post once I post this podcast there. That would be cool. Not that we're ever going to mention it again, but, you know, be cool. be cool to do it anyway. But I wanted to kind of go through these. I have separated them forever, and you'll see for a very specific reason. But I want to go through these. And, Kate, I expect you to chime in throughout all these to mock or whatever. Okay. So I am going to start off right now. It is going to be alphabetical order, at least the very beginning, because the very first thing is the letter A. Because I'm going to talk about that creature from the Upside Down. It's somewhat reminiscent of the alien from both Alien and Aliens. And if you think about all the different ways that it reminds us of that, you know, you got that ectoplasmic goo that it seems to be leaving everywhere. The fact that it seems to be using people like incubators, you know, which is the case when they find Will. And I feel that's kind of what that ending might be indicating of the series as well.
I would agree to that. There's part of him part of the Upside Down is still part of him.
Right. And of course, there's that moment also in the final episode when you see Hopper and Joyce, and they actually come across this weird hatched egg that looks just like one of the eggs from the Alien movies. So
that was one of those moments where I got really excited about when they came across the egg. I'm like, oh, that's a good one. That's a good one right there.
Yeah. So now they also in that, is it that episode or the episode before, the whole thing with the, actually it's the final episode, the stuff with the sensory deprivation chamber. that's really kind of a riff on Altered States, because which was a 1980 movie, William Hurt, which is all about, you know, experiments with LSD and people would be putting these sensory deprivation chambers, and they'd be, he'd go running around like he's a fucking werewolf or something. I mean, we've seen that in later shows over the years, like Fringe. I think it might have even been The X-Files as well. But what they're referencing here is really the 1980 film. But at the same time, when we see Elle being put into that kiddie pool with the hookup on her head and everything, it looks like it's a direct nod to Steven Spielberg's Minority Report, because she looks just like the floating precogs.
Yeah, in that movie. It sure did.
Now, since I've mentioned Spielberg, yeah, Spielberg is referenced oh so many times in both minor and major ways. So let's get to one right now. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Like Joyce, that she has that seeming obsessive madness and the way she like wrecks her house as she sets up that whole elaborate lighting system to communicate with Will. I mean, come on. That is a totally direct homage to Richard Dreyfuss, who acts just like a similar Looney Tune when he's creating like the Devil's Tower in his house in Close Encounters. And I'll even say it's probably not that much of a stretch to see there's like a parallel between the way she communicates with her son with the lights and the way the aliens communicate with sounds and lights in the end of Close Encounters. There's a similarity there.
A definite nonverbal communication way of doing it that uses something you wouldn't think of to communicate.
Now, sticking with Spielberg, and I'm not getting to the big one just yet. There's one I don't know if people caught this one. Jaws.
Yeah.
Now, Jaws, you know, it's not a 1980s film, but, you know, they do reference stuff from the 70s here as well. But there are a number of nods to Jaws throughout this thing. But getting back to the character of Hopper, think about this. Brody in Jaws. He's a big city cop who's relocated to a small town as sheriff. That's Hopper. We find, you know, and of course in Jaws, I mean, even though many things have done this since Jaws, it was the pioneer of, you know, the unseen menace until much later monster idea, which is kind of what they do here. It's a while before we really get a good look at that creature, right?
And I think that was one of the things I liked most, is that they took that ideal to heart. Don't show the monster all in episode one, because then you've ruined anything, whereas you can play off the whole we don't know what he looks like. They see glimpses of things just as much as we see when we see it. So that was a good choice to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that for the most part that's a budget choice, but it's also a smart storytelling choice, so it works. And back to Jaws, one last thing. One of the things they do in this series is they realize they can try to lure the monster with their blood. Which is kind of how you lure the shark in Jaws. You know, the shark is attracted to blood in the water, as you know, the people on the Orca were trying to do there. So I thought that was like another little Jaws reference as well. Now, I think I might have mentioned earlier, and if I didn't, I'll say it now. With this series, you have things which are more Easter eggs, like, oh, look at that, like a little fun little item you just see on screen or a line. Or you have things which are more character or story references to different things. Because since I mentioned Jaws, I should point out right now that we have movie posters for Jaws seen in the movie, as well as The Thing and Evil Dead as well. But those are just like, oh, look at that. It's not really, I don't think it really plays that much of a part in it, you know. Or even the Empire Strikes Back stuff. Because we should probably, since we're geeks, we should probably mention Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, the Lando thing so many times.
Dustin must accuse anyone and everyone of being Lando.
It's an insult for him. You're being a Lando. It's a good one too, though.
And up until maybe the end with what Hopper actually did, he's usually wrong. They also, I think they also make a number of references to Yoda in the show. And
the Millennium Falcon.
Oh, of course, the Millennium Falcon.
It's like right there.
Yeah, and I think the Force is mentioned as well. So about that Millennium Falcon and how the prominent use of it when it's floating in the air, whatever. To me, that kind of takes me to probably the biggest movie reference throughout this entire series. And you don't get more Spielberg references than this one. I'm talking about E.T. the Extraterrestrial. I mean, you could take out every other movie reference throughout this entire series, and you'd still have a ton left over that are just direct nods or lifts from E.T., which is pretty amazing and hysterical at the same time. So let's just kind of run through these, and you can check them off as I yap through them. So first of all, you're introduced to I would call them a suburban family that's been rocked by divorce, you know, which is the same in E.T. Winona Ryder's Joyce, she kind of sort of feels very similar to the Dee Wallace mom from E.T. as well, you know. That relationship that forms between Mike and Elle, there's a little touch of romance at a certain point, but you can't go too far with that because of how young they are. It's really more in sync with the Elliot and E.T. bond from E.T., I thought. Also, the whole point of hiding this other, which is like the alien in E.T. and Elle in this, hiding her from the family the way they do, it's very reminiscent of the way E.T. is hiding in Elliot's house. And when, you know, Ellie goes exploring through the house, it's just like E.T. walking around the house. I'm just glad they didn't go as far as to have her have like a psychic link with Mike or something. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's a little, you're going too far now, guys. her fondness for Eggos, waffles.
Loves them.
It's kind of like E.T. with the Reese's Pieces.
that scene when she went to the store and like would just took 4 Eggos and just walked off like, I'm taking these, you can't stop me, was one of the funniest moments in that entire
thing. I love that part. Obviously, the kids riding those little dirt bikes, whether they were BMXs or mongooses, I didn't check, but that's clearly an obvious E.T. thing. As is the fact that Elle helps them escape, only here, you know, instead of making the bikes fly, she makes the van fly over them. And then you have all the shots of, like, the guys in the hazmat suits and the flashlights in the woods. I mean, that's totally all E.T. I mean, the only thing missing was having Matthew Modine's character have, like, keys jingling from his belt or something like that. So I was floored by how much E.T. was in this. I mean, there's probably any number of other things as well, but those are things I actually bothered to jot down.
The wig.
Oh, my gosh. How did I forget to
mention that? I was like, I'll have to catch him. I hope he doesn't. But, yeah the wig, the way they dressed her up. Yeah,
we talked about that before we started recording, so it's kind of weird that I forgot to mention it.
And that's why it's still that was the moment I'm like, there's your E.T. Even with all the other ones, I'm like, that's the one that really strikes me as E.T.
Yeah.
The wig.
Right. The way Gertie dresses up E.T. and the way they choose to dress up Elle, it's very interesting that they do it in such a similar fashion. It's really goofy because you think in E.T., the little girl does this and Ellie kind of freaks out, what are you doing? And yet that's the way these boys, who we know have all seen E.T., choose to dress her up. Because, you know, the wig especially, but I'm pretty sure, like, even the outfit has a certain similarity, if I was to go back and check. So, kind of, sticking with the Spielbergian idea. Now, although technically he didn't direct the movie, but there's always been rumors that he did direct some, if not all, the movie, and not the actual director, Tobe Hooper. Gotta talk about Poltergeist as well with this thing. There's little things that happen, but I want to go to the big one because that was the one that was huge. Okay. You're dealing with the disappearance of a child into some other world or dimension, but it's still within the confines of the house somehow. And the child is still trying to, and to some limited extent, able to communicate with the parents, or in this case, the mother. That's totally Poltergeist, right?
Yeah.
Now watch this. This will be my personal favorite moment in the whole podcast. I will further say, because Poltergeist, in fact, to me, has always been sort of kind of a remake of a classic Twilight Zone episode. I believe the title of that episode was Little Girl Lost, which is also about a little girl in a house who ends up going into another dimension, and the parents are trying to find her, and they keep talking to her through the walls of the house. It's really interesting how similar they are. And I don't know why no one ever mentions that. Now watch. No, keep watching. Keep listening. Now that episode, Little Girl Lost, happened to be written by my actual all-time favorite writer, Richard Matheson. Richard Matheson, who wrote some of the most famous Twilight Zone episodes and other things of all time. He wrote The Nightmare of 20,000 Feet. He's the one who wrote I Am Legend, blah, blah, blah. But if you know your authors, Richard Matheson has always been credited as being one of the biggest influences on Stephen King. So,
well done, sir. Well
look
done.
How that all comes around. And if you think we're not going to be talking a whole lot about Stephen King in a couple minutes, you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Just wait.
But I've saved the Stephen King section. I've pushed all that stuff aside, but I just thought I needed to mention that now. Okay, a few quick little things before we get to Mr. King.
One other thing about Poltergeist.
Oh, go ahead. Oh my gosh. Oh yes, there is one more thing. Go ahead.
The little girl being drawn to the room where, like, the focal point was one that I immediately, the little blonde girl, Mike's younger sister, being drawn to there reminded me of Poltergeist.
That's right. That's absolute. How could I have forgotten that? Nice one. Excellent. There is one other thing I totally forgot to mention. Okay. I didn't spot this myself. It was an observation from someone online. I can't exactly say she's a listener because apparently she personally thinks that my audio is so awful she won't listen to our podcast. Unlike the audio of so many other podcasters that we listen to. But whatever. Anyway, she'll never hear this. But I'll give her credit where credit is due. She noted that the chairs that we see in the kitchen area of the Wheeler house are the exact same bent wood chair style that we see in Poltergeist. And when she said that, I was like, huh. And then I went and looked it up. I'm like, oh my God, how did I not see that? That scene where the chairs are all stacked on top of the table in Poltergeist. It's like, oh, those are the exact chairs. Of course they're referencing that. That's absolutely.
Yeah, I had to go look it up. But it's exact chair.
So I may not care for her opinions about my audio, but I give her high credit and points for coming up with that, spotting that reference, which was totally beyond me. It was Laura. Because she may actually listen. So Laura, kudos for that. Boo for knocking my microphone. I mentioned the posters with the thing before, right?
Yeah.
I also love the fact that the teacher is watching the thing and actually even explaining the special effects to his date. I actually had to look that up because I became a little skeptical because I'm remembering this is taking place in November of 1983, and I know exactly when the thing came out because my mother took me and several people in my graduating sixth grade class from grade school to see the thing. It was like a big treat. We all got to go see an R-rated movie. So I know that was like, oh, that's like early summer 1982. You know, it's kind of like the anti-ET that summer, quite frankly. And I was like, would it have been out on VHS in November of 83? I was like, because it wouldn't have been on TV at that point. I'm going to say it probably was. It probably was.
I think it could have been out at that time period.
So much time had passed, it probably was. But speaking of the thing, the electronic synth music that we hear, you know, with the opening credits as well as throughout the series, oh my God, that is so very similar to the kind of scores that John Carpenter, who you know, we know as a director, but he actually worked on the scores for his films too. It's very much like the music he did for movies like Halloween, obviously, or Escape from New York and things like that. Not The Thing, however, because that was Ennio Morricone. So that's a totally different guy. Let's see. If a lot of the Nancy High School angst stuff feels kind of familiar, that's because that's where I think they're totally wading into John Hughes waters with these movies, with this series rather. You can see a lot of elements of 16 Candles and Pretty in Pink with her relationship with these kids and them referring to her as like kind of like this princess type of character. And, you know, of course, Steed, he's a big Risky Business fan, so he's singing the Bob Seger song, and even has that party at his house while his parents are away. And even got that whole All the Right Moves reference. So they love their Tom Cruise in this thing, I think. What else do we got here before we get to the big one? Oh, if you get back to more of the horror aspects of it, I kind of think you even got a little bit of Nightmare on Elm Street going on here. You know,
with the upside down and how it worked and the flickering, and then you were normal and then you were out of it, that kind of thing. There's definitely some of that.
Yeah, it was kind of replacing dreaming with the way L accesses the upside down dimension. So yeah, the flickering lights, you know, everything. You know, it was very similar. And needing someone to pull her back, it had a very Nightmare on Elm Street quality to it. Let me see what else I have here. Oh, well, you kind of mentioned it earlier. I mean, again, this is one of the more obvious ones. I mean, we don't even have to point out how these kids are essentially like the kids from movies like The Goonies or Explorers or even Stand By Me.
Yeah.
And yes, now that's my opening to get...
There we are.
To get where we want to get. Speaking of Stand By Me... Can we just concentrate on the never-ending Stephen King homage this entire series is?
That might be the thing that, while it started, I'm like, oh, this is like Spielberg in the 80s. It's when Stephen King started dripping in, that's when the love, I knew this was the show I loved. This is when I'm like, this is in. I'm in for this.
I mean, you know what? This is going to be silly. Even the title kind of sounds like his name. You know, Stranger Things.
Stephen King, yeah.
Just had that kind of quality to it. So since I mentioned Stand By Me, let me just get that out of the way right now. I mean, you know, first of all, you have an episode of this show, which is actually titled The Body. The mm-hmm. Body is the title of the story that Stand By Me is actually based on. And in that episode, what do we see? We see a foursome walking along these train tracks, which is kind of one of the more iconic images from Stand By Me. And, you know, you can even look at how the characters look, especially Elle. Elle, kind of with that haircut and her insanely sad eyes, she sort of kind of even looks like Will Wheaton a little bit.
Yeah, you can definitely see that.
And, you know, plus the whole riffing on, you know, them being bullied and fighting back also has a very Stand By Me quality to it. The fact, since I mentioned the title, we should also point out that the title font that we see in that opening credit sequence for Stranger Things, oh my lord, it's totally and completely the classic Stephen King font that people saw on many of the early editions of several of his novels back in the day. If you go back and look at the lettering for the covers of the original editions of books like The Dead Zone or Skeleton Crew, of course, Needful Things. You know?
It is the Stephen King font. It's in your head. That's the you see that font, you're like, oh, Stephen King.
Yeah,
you know it.
Now, now we're going to start getting to stuff that I really enjoyed as far as the Stephen King references. Let's look at Elle. Elle, to me, she's kind of like a hybrid between Carrie and Firestarter.
Yeah.
You know, because her telekinetic abilities, that's totally Carrie White. But the fact that she's being pursued by this clandestine government organization, you know, who wants to do all these experiments, all this other shit, that's a total direct parallel lift of the shop that we see in Firestarter. The shop is the name of the agency that's in pursuit of the people with these abilities. I think the shop actually shows up in a few of his other books too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's one of his recurring things that he pops in every once in a while.
And also the fact that when she uses her powers, that her nose starts to bleed.
Yeah.
That's the same thing that happens to Charlie, that's the character from Firestarter, that happens to her dad whenever he uses his powers in the movie Firestarter. You know, and also all the scenes of Elle with the experiments in the lab is also kind of reminiscent of when they do have the girl played by Drew Barrymore, Charlie, in the lab in Firestarter. They're referencing his books, and they're also referencing his movies, you know, kind of interchangeably as well here. Trying to think of what else. There is another. I'm trying to see. Did I write it down later on? I didn't. I'm going to say it right now. I'm just going to. Another little thing which kind of made me think a little bit of Firestarter in the final episode when Chief Hopper threatens that he's going to give them up. He's going to have the whole story sent to the New York Times. That's how Firestarter ends, with her basically giving the entire story behind the organization to the New York Times, which is always kind of one of the weaker things in that movie, because in the book it's cooler, because I think she goes to the Village Voice, because the whole idea is to go to a publication that would be off the government's radar. They wouldn't think of looking for her at. but clearly I thought that was a bit of a reference there. But then if you switch back to Carrie, hey, you know what? Carrie, as anyone who's seen the movie or read the book knows, had a lot of fucked up mean high school shit.
Yeah.
So you can kind of see that happening here. Now I'm going to start going even further. You can stretch this a little bit. Now, let's look at Stranger Things here. One of the things we're dealing with this series is it's what goes on in this small town that's shaken by what appears to be the tragic loss of a small boy. Hey, you know what? That's also the major plot when Salem's Lot starts out. It's the same. Think about it.
It is, yeah.
And you know, also the fact that you're dealing with a small town, but nobody knows what's going on until, oh gosh, it's too late. That's Salem's Lot. It's also Needful Things.
Yeah.
You know, so you have those elements going on there. Now, I mentioned earlier that Joyce is kind of makes me think a lot of the Dee Wallace mom from E.T., we could also say she's the Dee Wallace mom from Cujo, you know, because, you know, fiercely defending her youngling against this menace, whatever. That's kind of what Joyce is up to here. Also, we all mentioned about the kids reminding us a bit of the kids from Goonies or Explorers or whatever. Hey, you know what they're really like? They're totally the kids from It.
They really and truly they are. Yes.
Totally the kids from It. With their issues and this, you have one kid with a speech issue, which is just like one of the kids, and It has like I think the stammer or the stutter, and said we have a kid with the weird lisp. He has to keep explaining it's because of the spaces between his baby teeth or whatever that kid was. I'm trying to think of what else we got going here. Oh, the one that I was so thrilled with. And it's such a huge part of the series, the entire concept of the upside-down dimension. That ain't Narnia, people. Mm. That's the darker alternate world called the Territories from the Talisman. That's totally the Talisman, which is for anyone who's not doesn't know their Stephen King that well, that's a truly fantastic book that Stephen King co-wrote with Peter Straub. And here's another little funny note. That's the book that for many, many, many years was always being rumored was finally going to be made into some big epic movie by none other than, ta-da, Steven Spielberg.
I remember reading those rumors, hoping it would happen.
Still hasn't happened.
Nope.
Now, I'm betting there may be any number of other Stephen King references. I don't know if you might have a few that I haven't mentioned as of yet. Anyone out there listening, if we don't have any more, if you come up with more, again, feel free to post them on the Facebook page. I'd love to see them because I'm sure. I've only watched the show like 1 1/4 times. I'm sure if I sat through it again, I'd probably come up with 10 more. I didn't see any evil 1950s cars or anything, so I couldn't go.
No.
And I didn't think there were any Shining references, so I guess you could go a little far with The Shine, but I was like, nah, I don't think so.
Not as much. Yeah, it's a little off with that one.
One more thing I might as well just throw in here since I'm here sitting here podcasting with you, or maybe I'll leave it to you to mention, because obviously they're referencing a lot of movies. I feel like, you know what, I bet they've probably referenced a bunch of TV shows and I probably just missed the boat on those. I probably haven't mentioned that. And obviously the books. But there's something else they reference.
There were comic book references, but there was a specific comic book reference.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I blanked on it. It's X-Men 163, correct?
No, oh.
See, I blanked. I blanked on the number.
I finally shut up and give you a chance. It's issue number 134. Oh, comic book geek, I'm ashamed of you. you know what? It's not a DC comic. Who cares? Go on.
I can't believe it. But that is the Dark Phoenix saga. Which, as we're talking about, a character possessed by some powerful force, it's very reminiscent of her when her powers finally manifest.
Yeah.
When she goes to fight, when the monster comes through and is threatening the boys, and when she goes to fight it, that's when you see the powers fully come to bloom.
Yes.
She's not breaking arms. She's not flipping. She's fighting something that we've seen how powerful it is. Just have it pressed against the wall to the point I don't know what the word to describe what she does to it. She just breaks it down at every little bit. It becomes nothing when she's done with it. That's how you realize her power level. She fully accepted her power. That was the moment where she accepted what it could do and let it take control. And getting to that point, you're like, they're leading to it because you know what that issue is. You're like, okay, that's a good little thing that they're playing here. But then you see that, you're like, that's why they put it there. They were specifically letting you go. We're going a place with this. It's going to be interesting when it gets there.
Right. Just to explain to our listeners who aren't comic book people, so they might not quite have gotten what we were talking about. In issue 134 of X-Men, you have one of the X-Men, Jean Grey. Maybe you guys have seen her in the movies if you've seen any of the X-Men movies. She's the X-Men with the telekinetic powers, much like Elle has. So the Dark Phoenix is, she kind of goes bad. She's kind of like this crazy evil bitch, pretty much at that point. So I would say, I would kind of go along with what you said. I might even take it back a few scenes earlier when Elle lays waste to all those people in that.
Okay, yeah.
And when she starts, basically imploding heads, which, ooh, that's kind of Scanners-y. Maybe it's kind of a Scanners reference.
Bleeding from the eyes, blood just pouring from everywhere in their face. Yeah,
I felt weird that I was actually cheering during that scene.
Oh no, I didn't feel bad at all. They were horrible.
I was happy
people.
That she,
they were gonna do terrible things.
I was happy she killed that lady because I was mad that that lady killed the chef from the diner.
The chef, look out!
Oh, I like that guy. And you know, and
speaking, I actually like the fact that the monster is what got Brenner.
Yes. Oh, it's a perfect kind of
him. That is him truly reaping what he sowed. That the monster that he basically caused to come forward is what finally got him. That was a fitting end for him right there.
Absolutely. So, looking at the series overall, I mean, as I was watching it, I will admit that I was concerned the further it went that I was going to get let down. Because, and we've all had that happen, we're into some show, you know, it's cool, it's creepy, it's interesting, whatever the kind of show it is. And then they kind of drop the ball in the last episode or two. And it's kind of like, oh, it just kind of didn't go where it should have or needed to or where we would like it to have. I don't think that happened here.
No.
And I was really... It might even sound weird. I was actually surprised because I was fully expecting to be kind of let down in the last episode. And maybe it's because I had looked earlier and realized that these guys had a hand in Wayward Pines. And I was thinking about how I felt by the end of Wayward Pines. I was thinking, they might fuck me here. I might not like the end of this. But I like that they were able to, on one hand, wrap up a lot, but on the other hand, leave a lot of questions up in the air for a potential second season. And there's a certain level of mystery there. And, you know, so we start having, you know, we can start percolating our theories about what does this mean? What does that mean? What can they do in a second season? You know?
Right. It was one of those things like you wanted questions to be answered. You hoped they would give you more questions at the end. And they did. They gave you an ending to where if it only had one season, you could still say, well, we got an ending. We moved on. We know what's going on. There's mysteries, but I can accept it. But there's still those mysteries that they can play off of. There's so much more that we don't know. Like, really and truly, we have no clue about the Upside Down at this point.
Well, let's just see if we can just run through what we got left with here. earlier we talked about Will. Now, my theory, and you're agreeing with me on it, is that there is some sort of incubator alien-like situation. That's why he's coughing up those bizarre slug-like creatures in the way we saw him earlier. So we think there could be something gestating inside him or something.
Well, just going by something I read today, they reference the fact that the Upside Down is toxic to humans. For him to have been in there so long, some part of it is in him. Right. For him to have survived it, he wasn't just pure human by the time he left.
Right.
Something was in him.
Has it become part of him? So has his own actual DNA changed at this point? Has he become a form of a hybrid at this point? Could be. We don't know.
Yeah.
But that's number one. Then number two, what happened to Elle?
Right.
Because when she takes on the creature and, you know, it seems like she and the creature both essentially disintegrate. But then we see the chief leaving that food, the waffles especially, and that little special little, what the heck was that thing?
It was like a little bread boxer type thing.
It's like a shaft or something. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck it was. Now, I have a theory, but it's just me just pulling something out of my ass. I have no way of knowing if it has any credibility whatsoever. My thinking is this, that based on what happened, because she was the one, more so than anyone else, who was traveling between the two dimensions, that maybe she doesn't have a firm grip on either one for any period of time. So maybe she kind of like flips back and forth. And actually, saying flips back and forth is actually a reference to the talisman yet again. Anyway, so that's my thinking, is that she can't be in either dimension for too long. So she just keeps bouncing back and forth. So that's what's going on there. Because I can't understand I can't come up with any other theory why the sheriff would still be able to get food to her, but why she wouldn't stay if that was the case.
And I think it is something like that. Her ability, her grip on our world was so broken by what she did. She's slipping between them. But she, at some point, she manifested in some way that he was able to find. Because he's not just putting – that's not just a random spot in the woods he decided to go drop some Eggos and some stuff off at.
Right.
It's like – it's an assigned meeting place that she knows about, he knows about. So when she does happen to be on our plane again, she knows where to go to get some food, to get something to eat.
Right. Absolutely. So I would say that's like your big number two mystery. Now, once you get beyond those two, then it's like, well, yes, would they want to explore the Upside Down world more to find out more about it or not? I could see them doing more with that or not. It depends. I think it may be almost a budgetary issue more than anything else. But it would be curious to see if there's more going on there. Because, I mean, are there other beings there? Other creatures there? Could there be versions of people there if they took it that far?
Right.
Which, again, would be referencing the Stephen King thing, because that's what happens in that. But it does make it curious. It makes me wish they didn't have an issue of budget. But I also wonder if they went that far, if it would still be able to maintain that kind of early 80s movie kind of feel. that's another risky take.
You don't really explain all that type. You don't really explain the monster that much. You would want it to be small things. You never want it to be a giant, hey, here's what it is and what's going on. It's little bits of information here and there that you might find out about it.
Hey, I got a question, which is like, I don't even know if it qualifies as a mystery. It's just more of a curiosity thing. And maybe one of the things that maybe sort of kind of drove me – I wouldn't say it drove me crazy. I was kind of like, I know it has to be that way because that's the way stories are, but it annoyed me. The Wheelers, Mike's mom specifically, because the dad's not really even relevant in the story at all, quite frankly.
As we were talking about the science teacher being quite a wonderful character they could have made, his father was the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, there's nothing with – I think they deliberately don't do anything with the father. I mean, he's totally nothing. But the mother is different. The mother is a much bigger character. I even recognize the actress. That actress is Cara
Bueno.
I know her mainly from Mad Men. Mm-hmm. She's in the great fourth season of Mad Men. She also had a recurring part over the last year or two in Person of Interest as well. I know she's done other things, I'm sure, but I'm sure Mad Men is the thing that's at the top of her resume. Here's my question. Because the frustrating thing is that she never seems to know about what's going on. You know? So by the time this whole story is over, and they're, you know, now they're all hanging around for Christmas and whatever, does she know what's happened or not?
That was a thing that was a question I had. It's like, is she that clueless character in the movie who everything falls apart around her? This crazy stuff happens, just they never notice or realize it happened. Like, they don't know why their child was gone for so long. Yeah, it's.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a flaw. It's not a flaw necessarily. It's just, I'm just curious about it. I mean,
yeah, it's never really something that was made clear if that's what was supposed to be.
I mean, as a result of that character being kind of a goof or a riff on movies of that era, you got the thing where, you know, kids can pretty much, back in the early 80s, kids can go run off and do whatever they want for as long as they want. And parents seem to not be aware of it or not care. Like your Goonies stories or Stand By Me or all those other ones. But this is a mother who never catches on that they're hiding someone in the basement or that her daughter has someone sleeping over that night in her room.
Like, twice there was somebody in her room and no one had any idea.
But what's interesting is that they when she actually has scenes with her kids, she doesn't seem to be oblivious. She just doesn't catch on.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, okay, I guess her kids are really sneaky. But I don't know. But I don't mean to, you know, we're getting near the end here and to end on like a negative thing about the show. I enjoyed it because it, you know, it's just kind of silly, but it was one of those, you know, you gotta go with the whole what they're doing an homage to. It's like, okay, I get why these kids can do whatever they want or why she doesn't seem to be aware of anything, because, you know, that's the way those movies were at that time. So, you know, I know I had to be home at a certain time when I was a kid, but whatever.
Yeah.
but I'm a city kid. Maybe in the suburbs you could get away with more stuff because people weren't being mugged and killed in the suburbs as much as they were in the city. I don't know. So I am definitely looking forward to where they're going to go with this. Have you heard if they have said if there's going to be a second season? Have they?
I've not heard an official thing. I know they've talked about they have plans for a second season. They've talked about, like, I read an interview today that just they recently did, and they talked about, like, they have a 30-page, like, basically a Bible of things of, like, the Upside Down, it is, all this thing, and they want to do more of this. They want to do more of the show, so it's like they have stuff ready to go for another season.
Right.
And with what it's the reviews it's getting and the attention it's getting, I don't see how we don't get another one.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix has been good about this kind of thing to begin with, and this is getting all sorts of notice and amazing reviews, from what I understand. I haven't really gotten the chance to actually read them as of yet, because I kind of wanted to go into the podcast without having my views tainted by anybody. Probably over the next day I will read them, but I know it's gotten high marks on, you know, Rotten Tomatoes and all that kind of aggregate bullshit, whatever. So I think it's a no-brainer that we're going to get at least another season of this, so I'm kind of excited about that. Because, you know, on one hand, it's going to be about where does the story go, as far as, like, the Upside Down world, and Will, and Elle, and everybody else. And you know what? I'm also looking forward to what other things they can reference, and they can...
Yeah.
Because there's so many more Stephen King things they could do. There's so many more Spielberg or other movies of that era that they can touch upon. You know they're going to, because that's one of the things that helped this season be such a success. So it would be kind of weird for them to suddenly drop that for the second season. So
yeah, the second season just be a story with no reference. I don't know if it would be – it wouldn't feel true to what the first season was.
Yeah. Although
– It would not
– Although they could be a smartass about it. And they could say, okay, you know how Aliens went in a totally different kind of feel and genre than Alien
did? Oh, that would be, okay, yeah.
So they could kind of go that way with it. You know, like,
two distinctly different movies right there. I mean, have their tone and everything.
I mean, hell, Back to the Future 2 feels totally different than Back to the Future 1.
It does.
So they could, I'm not saying I want them to do that, but I feel they will, you know. The poster for the show also is referencing Drew Sturzan style of movie posters from that.
Oh, era. Yeah.
So everything from like the Indiana Jones movies and Back to the Future and the Star Wars stuff. It's total homage to that as well. And it's actually a gorgeous poster.
I want to talk about real quick about something. The monster, there's a practical monster in most scenes in that movie. The monster isn't CGI.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
They had someone who worked with, like, has worked like Guillermo del Toro, which you can clearly see certain things there, but they talked about the headpiece, the flaps, call it pedals, are all randomly controlled by, like, a computer that the thing wears, so they move in random things instead of, like, patterns that you could pick up.
Yeah, that's really sweet that they did that. Oh, by the way, I love that you mentioned del Toro, because, yeah, that creature...
Oh, clearly, there's definitely his... when he has monsters, it's very much that.
I mean, wasn't it in... is it Pan's Labyrinth?
Pan's Labyrinth, yeah.
Totally looks like something straight out of Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, it's... And it's a more... Well, they have some modern references such as that, but the Upside Down, it's... When, like... A friend mentioned it to me today. She was talking about it. She goes, it looks like the game Silent Hill. And she did. She was right. And then I read an article with them, and someone's like, when you were designing the Upside, what were you really going for? And the first thing the brother said was Silent Hill. They wanted it to be as real world as possible, but twisted in a way that made it more uncomfortable for you because it wasn't so starkly different. It wasn't like some hellscape. Mm-hmm. It was your world. It was just like your world. And you think about it, but it's dark and it's twisted. But it's still your world, and it's uncomfortable because of how close it is to what you already understand and know.
Right.
And they said that's what they wanted the Upside Down to be. They didn't just want it to be some very different place. They wanted you to see it and go, it's just like this, and that's what makes it so uncomfortable.
Wow. See, not being a video game person, I never would have caught that, so I'm glad you brought that up. I'm sure a lot of our listeners do actually play video games or give a fuck about that stuff. I don't, but it's cool that you mentioned it. Oh, by the way, since back to that, the creature, whatever, and totally a del Toro kind of thing, you could sort of kind of even say, especially when the faceless face or whatever is kind of splits the way it does, it's kind of a little Predator-like, I think, also, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about the Predator's face kind of opening. Because I always thought the bottom half of the Predator's face almost had a weird flower-like aspect of it.
Yeah.
So, in a way, when it attacks, it kind of reminds me of that as well. Plus, the fact is, it's hunting them, you know, at certain points. Which, well, that's what Predator does. You know, it hunts them. So, I'm glad that we came up with even more references before we wrap this up.
We take too long, we'll have more, but that's probably not a good thing.
No, I think we should head towards the finish line now, because, you know, otherwise this becomes a crazy long podcast, and I think we're doing it in a timely fashion for a change. So I'm just so thrilled that we caught this series. It's rare that something practically comes out of nowhere, and when you watch one episode, or if you watched one trailer, it's like, oh, I gotta see this. I gotta watch this.
And we talked about podcasting after. I think you might have watched like three by that point, and I had watched two.
Yeah.
And even at that point, we were like, I want to talk about this more.
Oh, yeah.
This is something I know at this point, I want to talk about it soon, not like wait now. I want to cut what I've seen.
Yeah. And I don't want it just to be comments on a Facebook page. And this is one of those bad things, like when you're unemployed like me, you can't like go back to the office and yap about it for like a half an hour over lunch or something. It's like, no, I need to podcast so I can talk about it. So hopefully our conversation is more than just entertaining for the two of us. Hopefully the people out there will enjoy it as well. Okay, I'm getting a little tuckered out, so I'm going to wrap things up here. If you enjoyed this podcast, I hope you did, you might enjoy checking out our Facebook page. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast. like the page, join the page, and join the conversation. You can also find us on the iTunes the very same way, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to the feed as well as rate and review us. Every rating and review helps us along, unless you don't like my audio, in which case don't bother rating or reviewing us at all. And yeah, I can't let things go, sorry. And then finally, you can also catch us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. I don't tweet that often, but when I do it, it's probably not that worthwhile. But what the heck? Don't you want to have another follower? Come on, follow us. We'll follow you. I mentioned to Jason in one of the podcasts that you guys will hear probably next week, but I just realized within the last week or so, or week or two, we actually have an email address that I never give out.
We do?
Yeah. I still don't want to give it out because I don't want to be bothered right now. But maybe I'll make use of it, maybe when we get back to talking about the Flash TV shows and stuff like that. I don't know. But I just find it funny, like, wow, we have this dormant Gmail account that I've, like, never used. I went and found it, like, oh, look, there's two emails here from April of 2014. <You know? laughs> love this new Mad Men podcast. It's really pretty funny. But anyway, it was great getting together with you. I will be getting together with you soon, I think, to talk about Preacher. I think the plan is we're going to take a stab at talking about the first nine episodes.
First nine, yeah.
And then the week after the finale, after having watched the eighth episode, I'm like, yeah, I kind of want one more. Can I get one more so we can talk? Because I don't want to talk about it from that point on. And also for the folks out there, keep your eyes and ears peeled. There will be a few more podcasts I'll be releasing that I recorded with Jason. There's no reason to keep it a secret. We cover the following shows: Orange is the New Black, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, yes, a comedy, believe it or not, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, hey, wait, that's another comedy, what the fuck's going on here? And then in another podcast, back to Serious Dramas, we deal with Peaky Blinders and Bloodline. So we do have some stuff queued up, ready to go. Everything that was going to be dependent on Dan taking time out of his vacation in a motel room somewhere and editing the fuck out of these things, adding all the music that I've asked him to do. So hopefully we'll be able to get this all done for you guys. Okay? So, again, Kate, thank you very much for taking some time out of your life to talk about this wonderful new TV series.
Thank you for giving me a chance to ramble about my new favorite TV series.
All right, and with that, I will say goodnight to our listeners and goodnight to Cade.
Good night, guys.
I wish I could swim like dolphins can swim, though nothing will keep us together. We can beat them forever and ever. How we can be heroes just for one day. How we can be heroes just for one day. I will be king, and you will be queen. Though nothing drive us away, how we can be heroes just for one day. How we can be us just for one day.
and the guns shout above our heads.